It's Thursday, June 18th at 12:42 p.m. This is the Mincing Rascals, a freewheeling conversation about state, local, and national news. Our regular host, John Williams, is off today, so I'm your guest moderator, the execution-worthy Tribune columnist, Eric Horn.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Steve Bertrand from the WGN Radio Newsroom.
I'm Heather Sharon from WTTW News.
And I'm Darlene Glanton, a columnist at the Chicago Tribune.
I said I'm execution worthy because we've learned in former National Security Advisor John Bolton's new book, The Room Where It Happened, that President Trump has said that journalists who don't reveal their anonymous sources, quote, should be executed. They are scumbags. Elsewhere in the book, Bolton alleges Trump tried to get Chinese President Xi Jinping to help his reelection prospects by buying up agricultural goods from the U.S. He also encouraged Xi's efforts to detain hundreds of thousands of Uyghurs, a Muslim population in China, in re-education camps. He alleged that Trump didn't know that the U.K. is a nuclear power, that he considers Venezuela part of the United States, and that he thought Finland might be part of Russia, and that he believes there will be popular support for amending the U.S. Constitution to allow him to serve more than two terms. Darlene Glanton, welcome to the scrum. Are there any surprises for you in these and other revelations, or is this just Trump all over again?
It is Trump, you know, all over again. You know, I actually wrote a column right after the impeachment hearings, and I was so mad with John Bolton that I said nobody should buy his book. Let's just pretend he doesn't even exist. But I have to tell you, some of this stuff that's trickling out is just so interesting that it's hard not to pay attention. I might have to, like, I don't know, go out and read the book, actually.
Ooh. I'm totally with Darlene because I have had for a long time a searing hatred for John Bolton, and I now don't know what to do. Like, I still hate him just as much, and I don't know whether to take some things he says with a great, like, I don't believe what he says about, you know, the war in Afghanistan. So I don't know if I also believe what he says about Trump thinking Finland is Russia. So I don't know. I think he's been compromised in my brain.
President Trump said the book is filled with lies and made up stories, which means it must all be true because that's what Trump Bolton says he's doing.
Well, yeah, and if it's not true, then it can't be classified, which means that the president has just destroyed his case in court, which didn't really have a snowball's chance anyway. But it's, you know, it can't be both things, I guess. You know, either it's made up or it's classified. The president really has to pick one, and he can't decide. Now, I'm no big fan of John Bolton, although we have to respect the mustache, I believe. But, you know,
he
worked under Reagan. He worked under Bush. Like, this is the Republican establishment. You know, he knows how White Houses have worked in the past. And, you know, I guess I don't have any reason to disbelieve him, but especially because it makes him look terrible. I mean, that he sat on this information and didn't tell the American public during an impeachment process. And I got to say that the concentration camps item was one that caught my breath, because if we're to believe him, he heard an American president endorse concentration camps and then said nothing. And if that's not a statement against your own interest, I don't even know.
It almost seems like it opens him up for blackmail. If some of these things are true,
right,
and the Chinese know this, and now there's this second source claiming it, suddenly you've got a president who is beholden to Xi Jinping to say, like, don't tell this story, because it is incredibly damning. It is amazing to me that Trump unloads on people like Colin Kaepernick and yet embraces people like Xi Jinping and Putin and some of the world's worst dictators. And again, I mean, I would agree with what Austin said about Bolton being no hero. He certainly had every opportunity to at least try to tell this story and versions of it and elaborate on it during the impeachment hearings, and did not, which is, I think, when Darlene wrote her column saying, I'm never going to buy this man's book.
I'll give you my copy when I'm done, Darlene. But if you are the national security advisor to the president of the United States and you believe he is unfit for office, how it seems to me indefensible that you would go away without publicly declaring that when you came to that conclusion. I mean, to me, national security advisor, that's what the job is about.
Well, doesn't it also get to the whole idea that so many Republicans have shown so little courage during this administration? They've been so unwilling, with the exception of what, Mitt Romney? Is he the only one who's really been willing? And a little bit Susan Collins, a little bit Lisa Murkowski, but basically Republicans have just fallen in line behind this guy and not said a word. And this is just sort of another profile in cowardice.
And one of the things that I have not been able to figure out is, what are they afraid of? What can he possibly do to them that would, you know, allow them to be enablers of the ridiculous presidency that he is, you know, running right now? Well, I don't know.
I'll take a guess. He's afraid of the 40% of the population who would be willing to jam into an arena on a hot day with a pandemic raging in order to cheer for him. He's got really, really strong supporters. And if Trump raises a hairy eyeball at you, he can hurt your support among your constituents. And I guess the primary season's kind of over. So the question is, men and women going to start moving away from Trump? I don't know. I doubt it.
I don't think so, because I think he doesn't care about keeping the Senate. He cares about keeping his office. And if someone were to, if a Republican up for reelection were to be critical of him, I don't think he'd think twice about tearing him down. A general election be damned. So I understand why they're still, I think it's understandable why they're still afraid of that. It's not understandable why they don't stand up if they truly believe this stuff is true.
Yeah, I mean, the Senate Republicans care about keeping the Senate. And Trump still has a 95%+ approval rating among Republicans. So by standing up to him, you're thumbing your nose at your base, not just your base. Like, you know, it's more than your base. It's the entire party. It's not the fringes.
Before we get too far away from it, though, is Finland part of Russia?
Yeah.
As someone who has spent time on the Russo-Finnish border, yeah, I can say that they are not the same country.
Well, Venezuela is or is not the 51st state. I'm not sure about that. I guess the final question would be, the wrap up here is this book going to make any difference to anybody? Is this going to change any votes?
I think that you can clearly make an argument that even if Republican senators had read this book, knew everything, single thing in it, that it would not have changed a single vote. And in fact, Lamar Alexander from Tennessee said yesterday, look, I said he did this. I just didn't believe it merited removal from office. So, you know, I think that that's somewhat disheartening to some people who want there and have wanted for 3.5 years to be some magic bullet to sort of end this all. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, Donald Trump is clearly, you know, embraced by the Republican Party. He is not an outlier. He is, you know, sort of the central driving force behind it. And, that's just what it is. And it will be up to voters on November 3rd to decide whether he'll get another 4 years.
But I think this does add another stone to the wall that was being built in part by James Mattis and others. And now these Supreme Court rulings. I mean, I think that they are different segments that will give cover or persuade the Republicans, the John Bolton type Republicans, not the Donald Trump Republicans, to, if not support Joe Biden, to at least maybe stay home when it comes time to vote in November.
Well, let's hope so. Hey, this morning, Thursday morning, the Illinois Supreme Court ruled 6-1 against an effort by the Fraternal Order of Police, who are asking that all officer disciplinary records be eliminated after 5 years, as their contract calls for. They said the State Records Act supersedes this contract agreement, one that reform advocates have said hinders transparency and exacerbates problems caused by the notoriously slow and ineffective police disciplinary system that's at the heart of our national discussion these days. Austin Berg, I think I heard you whoop with joy about this decision all the way up here on the Northwest side.
It's a really interesting decision. And we talked about last week, I had a piece in the last week's Tribune about the problem with collective bargaining agreements when you're talking about police reform. And what the Supreme Court did today, I think, sets up some very interesting fights down the road. And what they did was say, well, yeah, the contract may say you have to destroy these records after 5 years. What they didn't say is, well, in the Illinois Public Labor Relations Act, it says that the CBA trumps everything else. They kind of just ignored that and said, well, this, you know, flies in the face of public decency that we, the court, are going to uphold the fact that people have a right to these records. There's a very compelling argument that that's not what the law says, and state lawmakers should be acting to change that law so it's not up to the courts to decide this, so all of this stuff is protected very clearly in state law. I didn't expect this result. And whenever we talk about police reform in Chicago, I get frustrated because at the end of the day, that collective bargaining agreement in law trumps everything except in these kind of odd cases. But it opens up a whole new fight for not just police labor agreements, but lots of other public sector workers too.
Now, I didn't read the opinion or the dissent, which I guess was pretty blistering. But I guess the question is, they say they're going to take, the union says they're going to take us to the Supreme Court, and they say that that there's contract provision is supposed to supersede the state records law. If they win, we have this problem where, you know, you're getting rid of these records. You don't know who the bad cops are. This flies against all the things we're talking about right now with police reform and accountability, the idea of maybe licensing police, making sure we keep track of these bad apples as they go through the process so that we don't keep hiring them again, or that their records aren't erased. Is reform even possible without a law that opens up all these records?
Well, I think Austin is right that it sort of opens the door that I don't think anybody really thought was open before now. So for example, police officers have a right to a 48-hour delay after an allegation of misconduct before they're interviewed by oversight authorities or internal affairs. So the question is, does that fly in the face of state law? You know, if you had asked me that 24 hours ago, I would have said no, that was a negotiated status of employment, and I would say, you know, you just got to negotiate it out of the contract. So it opens up the possibility that if the city is not able to reach an agreement with the Fraternal Order of Police, that they could essentially go to the courts and say, look, these guys want things that are, you know, in direct opposition to Illinois state law. Please order them to make a deal that complies with state law. And I got to say that is, you know, at least an avenue that could lead to a new contract with the FOP, which has been stalled for 3 years. And, you know, if I were Mayor Lori Lightfoot, and I am very glad I am not Mayor Lori Lightfoot, I would be seriously thinking about that as a way of sort of breaking open these negotiations. You know, and, you know, the FOP is never going to be on her side, so she runs very little risk of sort of alienating them.
Has the FOP's hand been really, really weakened these last, well, since May 25th anyway? We're having this national upheaval, this conversation about policing and how we need to really rein in all these problems. I'm sort of imagining how this ruling, how this would have come down in the news if this ruling had gone the other way this morning. They said, yeah, cops, we can get rid of the records after 5 years. That would totally go counter to the moment that we're now in. So I think that's right.
That's what the court was responding to. And to the point about how the FOP's tone has changed, they're back at the bargaining table now. Instead of going to an arbitrator, they're afraid that an arbitrator, while usually, especially in Illinois, the arbitrators are going to be on the pro-union side, they're going to lean that way. They might not be on the pro-cop side. So they realize the moment and that they may, you know, have provisions like this that an arbitrator would force upon them. At the end of the day, all of this stuff is being done behind closed doors. It's not being negotiated. It's in the courts. Just put all this stuff in state law. You shouldn't have different disciplinary procedures for bad cops. If the cop is in Harvey, if the cop is in Peoria, or if the cop is in Chicago, it should be standard across the board. And state lawmakers and Pritzker need to take up that flag.
Makes sense to me. Also on the police beat, the city council Wednesday tabled and in effect killed a proposal to remove police officers from Chicago public schools. An alderman friendly to Mayor Lightfoot used a parliamentary maneuver to shunt the proposal off to the rules committee, where legislation typically goes to die. Proponents say putting cops in schools sends a bad message and tends to criminalize normal kid behavior. and that the $33 million the district spends on this practice could be better used for other resources like counseling. Opponents like the mayor and the Tribune editorial board say local school councils can already opt in or opt out, and that some schools can benefit from the firm hand of a police officer on the premises, and that this decision should best be made at the local level. Heather Sharon, have I summarized this situation correctly?
That is accurate. So, I mean, it's dead for now, unless there are 26 aldermen who get together and vote to pull it out of legislative purgatory, aka the Rules Committee. That could trigger a hearing, that could trigger a substantive vote when it would go to the City Council. Are there 26 votes on the City Council to remove Chicago public or Chicago officers from public schools? There are not. But it is, I think, in a sense, low-hanging fruit for the sort of burgeoning movement to defund the Chicago Police Department. So it makes sense that it would start here, because these officers have been a point of contention for a really long time. They've been engaged in several instances of really shocking misconduct with students. And I think there's a larger question as to whether or not they help or hurt Black and Latino students, who make up the vast majority of students who interact with these officers. And, you know, it's important to note that these officers are only in certain high schools. They are not in elementary schools. And there are limited sort of limits on their behavior. But Illinois sort of got a history with this. It was only a couple of years ago that the state legislature banned booking stations from Chicago police, for Chicago schools. Booking stations?
Wow.
Officers could book students at the school and then transport them to jail, which is now no longer allowed. But I think it gives you the sense that these officers, for their history, have not been seen as like counselors or social workers. These are agents, you know, law enforcement agents. And I think it's an open question as to whether or not that's what Chicago schools want to be. You know, I live in Park Ridge, where there was a proposal to add school resource officers to the two high schools in District 207 that were in District 64, the middle schools. The high schools already have them. And it was eventually defeated by the school board because it was so controversial. And, you know, Park Ridge is pretty white and is pretty conservative. And there was a large number of parents who said, this isn't what we want for our middle school students. So, you know, I think this is one of those issues where it might change. Although, of course, the Tribune editorial board is thundering along that this, you know, will signal the end of civilization as we know it in Chicago.
I'm not sure they said that exactly, but
did you read that this morning?
Well, I mean, I guess they make the point. And Darlene, do you have a view on this that this should be up to the local school councils, that in fact that they are empowered to have police or not police, and that they would know, being in touch with the student body and the principals, whether or not this is a good thing. Darlene, you got any thoughts on that?
I feel as though we should be looking at this in the same way that we're looking at how policing in the general public, you know, should be changed at this point. We're talking about how police officers should be resourced. And do you need police officers handling traffic stops? Do you need them handling, you know, all kinds of things that someone else could handle? In the schools, I look at it the same way. I mean, I don't know that you need a police officer to handle a situation at a school where a kid, maybe even a kid, got into a fight. I mean, why do you need a police officer to step in and have to deal with that? The school to prison pipeline is very real. And it's unfortunate that in a lot of Black schools, the first contact that these young people have with law enforcement happens in the school. And it goes on from there, and it just snowballs from there, because they have a record that they can never get rid of. So I think that we ought to be looking at those things and thinking about how we can replace police officers with other resource people who could do the same thing without giving a child a record.
I think, and I will include myself in this, I think a lot of white people envision these officers in schools as officer friendlies, as somebody that the students can go to for help if they're having some sort of drama with another kid, or, you know, if they're having trouble at home. And that is just not what these officers are charged with doing, nor is it how they are trained to do. And I think, if anything, over the last couple of weeks, we have seen police officers respond in ways that I think everybody agrees it makes situations worse than better. And I don't know why you would invite that into a school setting when there's plenty of data that shows that it's not just sort of Black and Latino kids being sort of charged criminally, but it just makes them feel less safe and it makes them feel more nervous and it hurts their learning outcomes. And it just, you know, $33 million, which is what the city pays for these officers to patrol schools, it's not going to break the bank. It's a drop in the bucket, literally. The police department's budget is $1.7 billion. But, you know, budgets are a sign of priorities and values. And I think the city has to ask itself, is this what we value? Is this what we prioritize?
Scott Wagesback was on with us after the vote, and he said certain that it would come out of the Rules Committee. You guys are saying it probably won't, and if it doesn't, how does the Lightfoot administration make this happen?
So, I mean, the status quo is right now that the officers will continue. The only thing that could have to change the status quo is that if it comes out of the Rules Committee, that they could end this contract. I've heard lots of people say, hey, I'm going to get that out of Rules Committee. And it happens maybe right. once in a blue moon. Because again, it takes 26 votes. And if you've got 26 votes, you can do pretty much anything.
Whatever you want. Hey, yeah, one more question on policing. Is it possible that we rushed to judgment, so to speak, on Popcorn Gate, that accusation that lazy Chicago police officers broke into and lounged in the South Side offices of Congressman Bobby Rush while rioting and looting was taking place nearby?
That's a good question, because it certainly did happen very quickly, right? I mean, if you listen to that news conference, Heather, I don't know if you were there, but, you know, she said, or Bobby Rush said that he brought the tape to the mayor, I think the afternoon before, or even the evening before, and then there they were out the next early afternoon or late morning with this huge condemnation. And I said a few times, when people said it's obvious, it can't be, you know, it's clearly a terrible thing, I just said, I hope they didn't come out too quickly. And it seems like maybe they did.
Well, the Sun-Times editorial this morning said Chicago should wait on the facts. They called for a full and prompt investigation, which suggested there are a lot of questions. And the FOP, who I know we have already had harsh words for on this show, said that these guys were invited to come and help protect the office and that they were taking breaks after really long days fighting crime that was taking place and that had basically had subsided at that time. So I just wonder whether is this the mayor jumping the gun? Is this the media jumping the gun? Are we all jumping it together?
It's not the media jumping the gun. I mean, the mayor came out there very forcefully.
The officers in this incident and others we've seen in the past weeks. Jack, if we can show like this, have demonstrated a total disregard for their colleagues, for the badge, and for those they were sworn to serve and protect. And these officers will be held accountable.
She didn't call for these officers to be fired as she did, you know, when she acted sort of rashly with the guy flipping the bird.
That person needs to be immediately stripped of their police powers, and they should start the process for firing him.
But this was her, you know, and this was a very public embrace between her and Bobby Rush. It wasn't the media making too much of it.
Yeah.
That whole thing did change helped bend the news cycle in her favor, given the criticism that she was getting, for sure, right? Because especially among the left.
Right. I mean, you know, what it did was, you know, it cut both ways for Lightfoot, because on one hand, it was confirmation that there were police officers who were not sort of working around the clock to protect the South and the West sides. That was obvious, regardless of why those officers were there. I will say that there is no evidence that these officers were invited into Bobby Rush's office. And I haven't seen the tape, but I've had it described to me that these officers entered the office through broken windows. Now, I don't know about you, but if I'm invited to somebody's house, I usually enter through the door as opposed to broken out windows. But, you know, regardless of that fact is that these officers should have known that this is Congressman Bobby Rush's office. Like, I mean, there's a reason why that picture of the cop asleep on his couch has been everywhere. It's just, you know, we're going to see what COPA comes out with. We're going to see what Internal Affairs says. But I find it hard to believe that there's no, if there was evidence that these cops had been invited in there, that we haven't already seen it. And that if there's anything I know about Mayor Lori Lightfoot is that she is very careful. She has a temper, but she does not let that temper fly unless she feels like she's got all of her T's crossed and eyes dotted.
But you know, Heather, the thing about that is they didn't even know who these officers were. So they hadn't gone to any of the white shirts in there and said, what's the explanation here? They, you know, they might have waited a day or two. How hard could it be?
I mean, that's absolutely true. As far as I know at this point, which is, you know, almost a week since we saw these images, that none of these officers have been identified publicly. But you know, the fact of the matter is that Lightfoot, on one hand, was being sort of criticized for supporting the police. And on the other hand, she was being criticized for not putting more police on the South and the West sides. So I don't know that this is sort of a clear slam dunk win for her in any way, because it certainly, you know, sort of was something that the Black Caucus could point to and say, look, we told you that the South and the West sides were being left to burn. And here we've got, you know, officers kicking back and relaxing.
One of the things that I found very troubling was, I think it was the Monday after the looting had taken place that weekend, the mayor had her press conference that morning, and someone asked her a question about whether police officers were standing by while the looting was going on. This was way before that videotape came out. Mm-hmm. And she actually was very defensive in saying it never happened. Well, we knew it had happened because on social media, there were videos floating around, and one in particular on 47th Street, where you could see the police officers standing there watching as young men had formed a line to go in and out of a sporting goods store. They were standing there watching, doing nothing. And the question while that video was playing is, why aren't they stopping these kids? And so she was already in a position where, you know, she clearly didn't have all the facts about what was going on, but then was very defensive, which I find is sometimes a problem with her, that she becomes very defensive when she's questioned about something that didn't go the way it should have gone.
Who does that remind us of?
Yeah, I know.
John Williams?
Yeah,
John Williams, yeah. Yeah.
I'm talking about someone else. Okay.
You know, I want to ask one other question, though. I mean, you know, we cite the FOP and what they say. And but you guys tell me, has there ever been a situation where the FOP said, yeah, our guy was wrong, or yeah, our woman should not have done that?
Never.
I mean, I don't think ever. So,
they defend Jason Van Dyke. You know what I mean?
Like, they hired him. They hired him a job.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, I honestly don't know what kind of misconduct would get the FOP to say, you messed up.
Now, by nature, their job is to defend police officers. But
sure.
There's got to be a point.
And if you are a progressive, then you, by definition, believe that everybody should be unionized and that everybody should have that sort of defense, right? Like, you should have somebody fighting for you. The question is, you know, is that appropriate for when, you've got armed police officers making these sort of life and death decisions? I think that also is a fundamental tension that we haven't really dealt with as a society.
Well, and awesome. if your goal is to rebuild is to improve the lives of police officers, I would suggest not saying things that further foment the divide and lack of trust with the police department. And by lying through your teeth every time a police officer does something bad, you are only deepening that mistrust, which is
right. And you make it very hard for the public to trust what you say next time. If you come out and defend Jason Van Dyke, I don't know what they said about what happened in Minneapolis, but at some point you have to say, yeah, I mean, as we all do in our own fields, right? If somebody in our field like commits plagiarism or has some terrible offense, we don't all of a sudden rush to their defense and say, hey, everybody copies from now and then. You know, you don't know the stress. You don't know the stress we're under.
Wait, is plagiarism still wrong?
I think so. I'll check on that. Hey, Dolly and Glenn, your column this morning uses the occasion of the end of Aunt Jemima as a way issue of racist symbolism and how we now seem to be in a moment when we're reevaluating the pernicious power of all sorts of imagery. You wrote that Quaker Oats Company always knew that Aunt Jemima was a racist stereotype, changed her image in 1968, again in 1989 to make her appear more socially acceptable. They kept using her to make money until now the social climate in America has shifted and these blatant racist acts fall out of fashion. And you put this move in context of how officials in Jacksonville, Florida just removed a 122-year-old monument to a fallen Confederate soldier. Same is true in Louisville, Alexandria, Norfolk, Mobile, Asheville, and other cities. You wrote that these fixtures had no place in public squares, forcing tax-paying African Americans to pay tribute to figures who fought to keep black people enslaved. And you noted that Confederate culture, with its ubiquitous and that somewhat marginalized battle flag, promotes racial division and white supremacy. And you suggest that these sorts of symbolic changes will just be window dressing until we make substantive changes to address what even Mitch McConnell now admits is the lingering stain of slavery.
Right. You know, I feel like these are kind of things that make us feel good. So first of all, I think they make the white establishment that supported these things for so many years feel like they're, you know, maybe we weren't so bad, you know, maybe people will look at us differently now and understand that we're trying to, you know, do something. Well, for me, all of this is just very surface things, because this is one thing about African Americans that I know, because I've been around for a long time and I grew up in the South. I grew up with all of these images. And yeah, they were there in my face. I didn't like them. But at some point, you become accustomed to them. And you don't wake up every morning thinking, oh, that Confederate flag, oh my God, what are we going to do about that? You know, because it's part of what America is. We're not concerned about that. You know, those are not the things that are foremost on our mind. We are worried. What we're concerned about is how are we going to improve situations where we have equal access to jobs, to education, to the things that everybody else is able to take for granted? And until we deal with those kinds of things and the systemic racism that contributes to our inability to obtain those kinds of things, then we're not going to get anywhere. And to me, it's nice. But it doesn't make me sleep better at night. I mean, it just doesn't do it for me.
If you were Quaker Oats, or it's Quaker, right? Who owns that brand?
Yeah. It's Pepsi. Pepsi.
Quaker, okay.
That owns
Big Quaker Oatmeal.
Right.
But but if you're them, Darlene, what do you think is something that is? I feel like this is so weird for brand. Like, I don't need to know what like Fruit by the Foot's racial politics are. But at the same time, if you're the people who are constantly never changed this image, despite, you know, widespread discussion about how terrible it was forever, what do you do now? Does that look like more money for certain things, or internally changing your hiring practices? Or like, what are the other things that companies should be thinking about that isn't just changing, like taking Aunt Jemima off of the bottle?
I suggested in my column that you go over to the West Side and open a processing plant. I mean, you know, their processing plant now is in Iowa, but, you know, it would make sense that it would be there because it's a farming community. But in fact, they import their grain from Canada. So the processing plant could actually be anywhere. So, and I just said that because they're based here, they could really open a plant anywhere. But it's those kinds of things that I think make a difference. And I found it really offensive that they say they're going to donate $5 million over 5 years to Black causes, whatever that is. I don't even know what that is. This is a multi-billion dollar company that has made much of those billions from Aunt Jemima. And you're talking $5 million to Black causes? What is that? I mean, I'm offended by that, really. You're just going to throw out some cash and we're going to feel better about what you've done for 120 years?
Yeah, I mean, but don't you think that this kind of, that kind of change wasn't going to happen unless you saw some of this momentum, this symbolic momentum, like what NASCAR did getting rid of the Confederate flag and all these statues coming down, this revulsion that so many people are now finally giving much more voice to for honoring Jefferson Davis and Robert E. Lee, that this message does then go to places like Pepsi, Quaker Oats, and they see this and they start making these changes. And then you come back at them and say, well, that's nice that you've done this, but let's take advantage of this momentum. I agree these are sort of our small things. And I've had people write to me and say, you know, what good does it do? And I wrote earlier this week about the national anthem. And I said, what good does it do if people are protesting the national anthem? And I said, well, you know, we've got big problems. Yes, we do. But some of the symbolism does push organizations and businesses and so on in the right direction. Am I being too optimistic?
I think you are, because I think these corporations, because here's the thing, Eric, they've always known what they should be doing and they chose not to do it. Here's my thing. If you've read my columns, you know that I'm not really all that optimistic about where any of this is going in the long term. Because I really feel like this is an in-the-moment movement. And that a year from now, especially once the elections are over, people are going to like drift back into what is considered to be normal. And this is no longer going to be a priority. When the attention goes away, everything goes away. And I just don't see this moment, because we've seen it so many times. I hope I'm wrong. But we've seen it. We saw it with the civil rights movement in the 1960s. We've seen it so many times, and it just does not sustain. And it's not something that African Americans can sustain on their own. We have to have white support. We have to have overwhelming white support for this movement. And I just don't think it's going to stick around as long as we need it to.
I think if I can speak for white people,
Did they take a vote to appoint?
Okay, just for Austin and myself. But you know, I was struck when Tim Scott unveiled the Republican policing policy, or the bill, and you can think whatever you want of it. But he talked about all the times he was driven, pulled over while being Black.
In the course of 1 year, I've been stopped 7 times by law enforcement officers. Not 4, not 5, not 6, but 7 times in 1 year as an elected official.
And he said one case happened just earlier this year when he was pulled over, an African-American senator from South Carolina, and he was pulled over and given a warning ticket for turning his turn signal on too late. I mean, you know, that's a striking story. Kwame Raoul was on with us just earlier today, and I brought it up and I said, you know, had anything like that happened to you? And he said, of course. And he started right away, told the story. He said, when I was a kid,
I was driving down Chicago Avenue. I was at DePaul University. My mother had a fairly new Mercedes-Benz, and I had just dropped her off somewhere. And I had a buddy in the car with me, and a car cut me off. Another one pulled up behind me, and they were unmarked cars, and they came out with their guns and told me to get out the car. I thought we were getting carjacked, but they were police officers, and suspecting that we had stolen the car. Because it's a brand new car, frisked me and asked me whose car it was. I said my mother's, and they said, "Yeah, right." Eventually, I ran the registration and found out that it was my mother's, and told me to get out of there.
So, I think there's benefit to those of us who are ignorant to all of this to hear how systemic it has happened and how it has happened to people who we watch on TV or watch at the baseball diamond or follow in the church or things like that. I mean, I really would like to see a campaign of that and hear those stories from people.
No, I was just going to say that the risk is that if, as these stories fade, and they will, because something else will happen and the media's attention will move on, that us white people who are not afraid of driving in a Mercedes in any neighborhood, we will stop caring as much, or we will get tired, or we will say, gosh, didn't we solve that? I mean, literally, people have said, you know, we elected Barack Obama president. Didn't that end racism? Like, can't we be done with this? It makes me feel sad. And I think that the risk of symbolic actions like dropping Aunt Jemima or Uncle Ben is that it makes us white people feel like, okay, we're done. Right. All right, let's move on to the next thing. Also, it's been a really long, hard couple of 6 months. So if we could just talk about like happy things from now on, I would really appreciate that. And I think it's incumbent upon white people like myself to say, hey, you know what? That's just a symbolic move. Let's talk about jobs. Let's talk about economic investment. I mean, you know, I don't think we really have a full sense of sort of the damage of the looting in the last couple of weeks on the South and the West sides, but I, you know, sort of shocked and amazed coworkers by saying there are still blocks on the West side that have not been rebuilt since 1968. They burned down in 1968 and nothing has been rebuilt. And they looked at me like I had grown a third head. Like, literally, they're like, that can't be true. And
third head.
I said,
yes, too.
I said, you know, I don't make stuff up. You know what I mean? Like, that's just the honest truth. And I think those empty lots on the West Side should be a warning to white people that we are going to, you know, there are going to be people who are going to get tired of this, where people are going to get frustrated and are going to want to move on. And if, you know, we just can't. We just can't.
And I'm sure Darlene hears from them by email, as I hear from them by email. There are lots of nasty and intemperate and impatient people out there who want this all to go away or want to change the subject. And, you know, I have the same fear that we're going to be in a Sandy Hook moment, right, where everyone's like, oh, my God, this is really horrible. What happened in this case in Minneapolis, in that case at the elementary school? And then everyone says, something must be done. We must do something. And then a few weeks later, it's like, what was the name of that place again where that bad thing happened?
So, you know, I'm sorry. One thing about symbolism, too, is I would be much more impressed if the Senate had not gone to their lone African-American senator to take full responsibility for that bill. I would be more impressed if someone like a Lindsey Graham, perhaps, stepped, which would never happen, of course, that's ridiculous. But someone, a Republican, would have stepped up and said, you know, I want to take responsibility for this bill because it's important to me. And I have, you know, I can get the support I need for putting this bill together. I think to fall back on the lone black senator that you have to do something like this because it involves black people is typical of what we're used to in this country.
Well, and you know, Senator Durbin got into a little trouble with that too, right? Where he was characterizing the legislation as, and he called it token legislation.
What we say on the Democratic side is we cannot waste this historic moment, this singular opportunity. Let's not do something that is a token, half-hearted approach.
Senator Scott, I think, was the one who called him out.
To be considered a token piece of legislation, because perhaps I'm African-American and I'm the only one on the side of the aisle.
Durbin apologized right away.
Well, I mean, if you want to talk about symbolism and the importance of symbolism, it does seem to make it seem like racism is a black people's problem, right? Like, if Tim Scott is the one who has to go out there and push the legislation through, it sort of makes the argument implicitly that it is on black people when it's just not. I mean, they are the victims of this systemic racist society. And it's sort of like you're punching somebody in the face and you're saying, you need to figure out a way to stop me punching you in the face. And it's just ridiculous and frustrating. And I can only imagine that Durbin was pretty frustrated that his choice of language got him into a situation where he had to apologize. When, let's be honest, Tim Scott, if he wasn't black, would not be championing this legislation through the Senate. And that's on the Republicans. And that's, you know, sort of on us as a society.
But I want to go back to Darlene's pessimism for a second, though, because when these things happen, right, when social movements happen, there's a great charge forward. And then there is a retreating. There will be a retreat from where we are today. But don't you think we will have moved forward at least as well? Or are you giving up on that even?
I do think that there will be some changes. I think there will be reforms in police departments. I do think some of those things are going to change and they will be beneficial. But what I also realize is that if we don't keep watching these things and remain diligent about them, there will also be efforts to reverse them. We're seeing that right now with voting rights. We're seeing it with all kinds of things that we thought we won in the 1960s that are now being challenged as if they never happened. And that's what worries me. If we don't go far enough, we just got to keep our eyes open. We can't relax on these things.
Getting specific, I think, is a very good antidote to that. And because it gives you a guidepost on, you know, has there been progress or not? And you can keep pointing to these, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 points. And I think that's really important that people, so like Black Lives Matter Chicago, you can go to their website. There's 10 demands. You can agree with some of them or disagree, but they're specific. And that has been really encouraging to see people really getting into specifics. And I hope that the conversation doesn't move away from that. One thing on Tim Scott, I think it's important not to diminish his agency or passion for that cause just because he's black and in the Republican Party. And he was asked, he was on the Today Show and asked sort of point blank, like, don't you feel like a token? And he's like, well, first of all, that's insulting. And secondly, I feel most equipped to talk about this issue because of the discrimination I have personally faced that my colleagues have not. That is not to say that there should be far more white senators standing with his effort to do that. But I don't see a problem with him if he wants to leading that fight.
I mean, he certainly can. I'm just saying that, you know, it reinforces racism as not white people's problems. And I think that it's not, and that's not accurate. And I think that's damaging because it lets white people think, well, you know, I haven't actively been racist towards somebody today, so I probably don't need to worry about that, when we all benefit from the system in ways that we are not fully conscious of. But, you know, there have literally only been less than a handful of black senators. And, you know, for him to sort of take a national role only on this issue, it sort of says, well, what else is he passionate about? You know?
Well, he's led on school choice. I mean, that is his big issue, his school choice historically. But it's not as if he hasn't talked about these issues.
It's problematic for him to say, you know, don't criticize me for leading this fight when, you know, there's clearly and sort of, you know, that it's in the Republicans' interest to have him, you know, sort of leading this effort. I don't think we can look past that.
You know, this is so superficial, but it comes during the moment of this pandemic when we're all wearing masks as well. And, you know, this is the time when we should be, you know, when I walk back to my car, I will generally walk past 2 or 3 African-American couples walking one way on the bridge or something like that. And these are the moments when we should be meeting each other's eyes, and you can do that with the eyes in a mask, but we're not meeting each other's faces and giving each other sort of a view of companionship that I would like to be able to do right now. I don't think that probably makes the world stop, but it is something that I am sorry about.
Hey, Darlene, I want to give you the last word on this conversation.
Yeah, and I want to say something about tokenism, because I've been the first black this and the first black that. You know, Dick Durbin, as a white politician, cannot call a black man a token. I'm a black woman. I can. And the truth is, the Republicans have turned him into a token. He doesn't have to accept that responsibility. He could come up with a plan that really makes sense and that would be beneficial to the whole country if he chose to. From what we see so far, he hasn't done that. So if he really wanted to be someone other than a token who's going to toe the Republican line, he has every opportunity to do that. And I certainly hope that, you know, he will choose to, you know, take that route.
That's Darlene Glantz and my colleague at the Tribune. We've also been joined by Steve Bertrand at WGN, Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute, and Heather Sharon of WTTW Channel 11. Thanks, everyone. And John Williams, I think, will be back next week, unless I've done so well today that he just resigns in disgrace.
I think it's 50-50.
Can we make a motion to have you never run news again?
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.